Bienvenidos a Líderes Inquebrantables. Soy José Pereira y hoy hablamos del verdadero liderazgo frente a los mayores retos. Esto es Líderes Inquebrantables por Now Media Televisión. Welcome to Líderes Inquebrantables. I'm José Pereira, your host. And today we're going to underneath leadership strategy and straight into what gets tested first in adversity, the nervous system. Because when uncertainty hits, markets shift, teams shake, and personal pressure rises, leadership becomes less about what I know and more about who I am under the stress. My guest today is Dr. Jesse Hansen. He's a clinical psychologist. He's a somatic and neuropsychology specialist and the founder and the lead therapist at Hansen Healing. He is also clinical director and co-founder of the mentalhealth.com, co-founder of clinical director of the Atman Resorts and Retreats. And he spent 4 seasons as an interventionist on A&E intervention. Dr. Hansen works bridges modern neuroscience with ancient healing wisdom, so leaders can move from survivor mode into grounded, effective action. Dr. Hansen, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Jose. Muchas gracias. I'm very happy to be here. And this is the stuff I love to talk about. So grateful to be on your show.
Well, I love what you're doing, combining the neuroscience with ancient healing wisdom. It's going to be a very interesting topic. So let's start this with what leaders rarely say out loud. So let's talk about the high-pressure seasons. Leaders can look fine when their body is fight or fight. The segment connects adversity leadership to nervous system regulation. So viewers understand why clarity disappears under the stress and how the resilience can be trained instead or fake it. So let me start with a question. When leaders are under prolonged pressures, what is the first thing you can see change in their nervous system before they can even notice it?
Beautiful lead-in, Jose. And I'll start with what's intended to be a joke, a little bit of humor to a heavy subject. You used the word fine a second ago in your question of acknowledging can look fine from the outside, but feel very different on the inside. And in the back office of the psychology office, we have an acronym for when we say, oh, I'm fine. It actually means funky, insecure, neurotic, and emotional. Yeah, everything's fine, but I'm secretly holding so much back. And so I appreciate that, and hopefully we can laugh at that a bit. And I think we all can fall into this category sometimes. And yet, definitely leaders who are going through such high pressure scenarios, that pressure, you know, causes a lot more ways they have to deal with what's going on inside. And yet the culture is such that the leader is supposed to be strong, solid, not be vulnerable, and just hold it all together. And it is that last line, holding it all together, Jose. That's where you start to bring in the neuroscience and the somatics, the body-centered approaches, because guess what? It's the same for any of us, whether we are big-time CEOs or leaders called moms and dads who have a big job to do at home and things come up. You know, it takes when we have an emotion coming up and we're not in a place that we can best process it, we have to hold it in. And that literally takes neuromuscular contractions. It takes ways of creating tension in the body. And so I would say, I couldn't say there's one specific, well, I guess if I had to, I'll tell you what it is, but more what I want our listeners to understand is that it's probably gonna be unique per person based on a lot of their own emotional patterns and developmental patterns. And yet it is some kind of what we could say holding pattern, which if I did have to say one, I guess I would say it would be the jawbone. It would be, you can kind of track when people are fine and holding it all together, often their jaw, whether or not they're grinding their teeth, but it's pretty locked. And that's one mechanism that we use often unconsciously to keep it all together. I can go on about more, but I want to hear how that lands with you, Jose.
Well, that's very interesting. I was thinking in something because you have worked with the high stakes environment, you know, from a clinical work to the intervention. What does the word resilience actually look in the body, not in the mindset?
Great question. Resilience is more or less in the nerdy world of neuroscience, resilience is gold. Resilience is a key. One of the most common ways we learn about this is called the process of rupture and repair builds resilience. And that's both a psychological statement and a neurological statement, meaning the kid who's so well protected and nothing bad ever happens, they don't actually build a lot of resilience. They can function within a certain parameter, but it is actually going through rupture. And rupture could look like falling down on your bike and having a parent that is very loving and kind and says, oh my goodness, are you okay? Let's get you cleaned up. And what did we learn from that? And let's work on it. Versus the parent that's either not there or shames them or whatever it is. The resilience is built from that process of moving into a rupture and being supported in a repair. And why that is so golden for the nervous system is because it teaches us how to have access to more of all the, almost look like neural networks, as if you had a mountain and you have water, a massive amount of water coming down it. If you've only got one or two channels, the water's always going to go down those same channels. When you start to go through ruptures and repairs, you learn how to adapt to different challenges, you build more channels so that the water starts to move more well distributed across the metaphorical mountain, which is us. So it's resilience is such a powerful thing, and it's so important for all of us, but really for leaders, not only to have their own resiliency, but to understand this process of rupture and repair, because I cannot tell you how many corporate environments I've been brought into because the leader, the CEO, COO, whatever role they're in, it feels like a tyrant. And that is the sense that there is no real room for repair. If it's rupture, it's you're in trouble and you're ashamed. And, you know, so I feel like when leaders can know this and show this and help people learn when they make mistakes, just like the kid falling off their bike, then you get a whole different corporate culture. And I would also argue that the leader gets a whole different experience of who they are as a human being, rather than being perceived as a tyrant. I am perceived as someone that can be strong and yet also show some compassion and show know how to build resiliency within a team.
Yeah. You know, I have a podcast called Building Resilience where I talk always about that. You know, maybe your audience doesn't know, but I went through a hostage situation. And one of the things that I discovered during that time was that I needed to build resilience. But because we went as a survivor, we went to the survivor mode. So they just come to the question here, what are those hidden tells that someone is leading from their survivor mode?
Another way to shape that is the, you know, fight or flight, right? How do we tell when someone is in fight or flight? And there are some key common ones, but it's really a sense of, if you think, you know, just imagining for ourselves being in fight or flight, as soon as I imagine it, it's a little bit more on edge. And so restlessness, tight jawbone, bouncing legs, bouncing finger, you know, body parts kind of bouncing when we could just be still. Ironically, I've actually worked with a lot of people that realized, like, sitting at their desk, they always lifted their heels up. Even that was a little bit of fight or flight. You know, they were ready to leave. And so I think, you know, these are some of the hidden tells, as well as just, you know, a lot of times our facial muscles can give things away like that, you know. But it's so important to be able to track these things for all of us in our life, both in ourselves and others, because I'm sure you know this, Jose, but that's common said, 90%, whatever, the percentages can vary a bit, but the high percentage of our actual communication is nonverbal, meaning through the body, through posturing, through tones, through all these things.
Okay, well, we're coming to the end. We have a minute left. So we're going to be talking next segment about decision-making in crisis, how leaders can slow down internally without losing the momentum externally. Stay tuned and we will continue the next conversation. No te muevas. Regresamos con más historias y estrategias para mantenerte firme cuando todo se te pone a prueba. Esto es Líderes Inquebrantables por Now Media Televisión. Estamos de vuelta. Soy José Pereira y estamos viendo Líderes Inquebrantables en Now Media Televisión. Sigamos descubriendo qué significa liderar sin quebrarse. We're coming back to Líderes Inquebrantables. If you want to hear more episodes like this, you can watch Now Media TV live or on demand. Download the app on Roku, iOS, podcast at Now Media TV. You can see my podcast there. Welcome back to Líderes Inquebrantables. I'm here with Dr. Jesse Hanson. And now we're going to be stepping into the moment with every leader faced eventually, making critical calls when I don't have the perfect information. So let's deep dive on this. And everybody's looking at me. When stakes rise, the brain narrows. Leaders can confuse urgency with clarity. This cement gives viewers a crisis framework rooted in the neurobiology. Regulate first, then decide. So action is clean, not reactive. So I give you the question. In your work, what is the difference between the fast decision and the reactive decision? And how do you handle the spot in the real time?
This word decision, Jose, it carries so much weight for me lately as a psychologist and human being, a father, so many ways in which I have different roles in my life, as I know a lot of us do, is realizing, wow, it really is the decisions I make on the daily that sculpt my life, sculpt who I am, sculpt who I'm becoming. And so when I hear you ask this question, first and foremost, it comes to me to just not take for granted or breeze over the notion of realizing how we make decisions in general matters a lot. And yes, to the point of your question and then this segment is that when the stakes are higher, decision making often feels harder or at the very least more intense. And so from that, Jose, I would say that, you know, it comes down to what I call the emotional operating system, the EOS that we all have. And depending again on so many variables that started back in our childhood up to our present day life in terms of our daily practices and the way we live our life, for example, the person who gets up and drinks coffee right away and gets going and no judgment, I have mornings like that versus the person who gets up and has that ritual built in to take a few minutes for meditation, prayer, movement, whatever it would be. Already by that move, that second option in the morning, it's setting me up for wiser decision making through the day. Now, again, I know we all have busy lives, and I'm not saying that to make any of us feel guilty that we're not doing that or highlighted if we are, but just to name how we live in our body, how we are aware of, is my jawbone tight while I'm making this decision? I can't tell you how many times I've seen, you know, this crossed arm, closed off, tight posture as I ponder what I'm going to do. And then I, from this posture, I often, if not always, decide to go with the decision that's more based on either fear or contraction. Whereas if I'm holding into a more neutral posture and breathing in that way, deeper and slower, I find it's easier to really see all the different pieces of the puzzle, which shifts from a reaction into a conscious action that is attuning to the present moment and attuning to what's really happened. So many times we're all making decisions based on past or future imagined outcomes, as opposed to really being attuned with presence. Yeah. Easier said than done, by the way, humbly admit, but I know the map, Jose.
And let me tell you something. You were mentioning about the meditation and the morning prayers and talking about neuroscience. When you are meditating or you're doing your morning prayer and you're doing the intention and you're setting the tone in your brain, how you want to start your day, and that will create the atmosphere of what's going to be your day. So what do you think about that?
1,000% resonate with your words, Jose. There's no question about it. There's actually, now we live in a time, and this is where I feel so blessed to have found neuroscience and specialize in it, because it is a lot of ways it validates these ancient practices and these ancient ways of living, meditation, prayer, One of the other key themes of my work is about embodiment, which is simply it's not just going to the gym to work out, though that supports embodiment. It is this shift in our consciousness where we no longer live in the mind-body divide, but catch up to modern neuroscience to realize whether we like it or not, our brain body is fully one organism, interconnected, and everything that all the neurology that moves through our neuromuscular system is woven into our brain. And when we realize that scientifically, it means, wow, I need to, in a way, befriend my body. And instead of thinking of it like a machine where I take this to make me feel this way, and then I'm too high, so I take this to go to sleep, or I vice versa. And then again, no judgment on that. It's just seeing how far collectively as a culture we have gotten away from this embodiment practice and into this way of just sort of rushing through and hyper productivity. So I do think that absolutely a meditation and or prayer practice or breathing, anything, even 5 minutes. This is a good one too, or for our listeners too, to encourage people to continue to awaken and become more conscious. Is that the most recent research out there shows that actually shorter, more often incremental meditations is actually better for us than an hour a day? Because it's so often it's like, oh, I want to do that, but I can't find the time. Well, hey, 5 minutes, set a 5 minute timer, maybe once, twice, thrice a day. And it's still going to help our brain start to learn how to slow down as well as make more conscious decisions.
And you're talking about 5 minutes. People sometimes complain that they don't have 5 minutes. Come on.
So
What
then you do
happens
two, and then you do
neurologically
two,
when
and
a
then you build
leader
it up to
tries to
three.
think their way out of the fear, but the body still is bracing for impact?
It's basically what I hear in this question is the neuroscientific understanding of trauma. It's that's what happens to us. All of us have something that happens that's less than perfect, and if we don't know how to, what in the neuroscience world is called sequence, that neurological phenomenon, that energy in our body, if we don't know how to sequence that, then it stays in us, and so we can stay in that fight or flight mode, which is then what we bring that into work, whether as a leader, as an employee, as wherever we go. And so it is again where this is a theme on my show as well that we always talk about is, by doing the deeper inner work and starting to do work that involves us having deeper self-understanding, that does help create nervous system regulation, which creates healthier choices, healthier relationships, healthier way of living. And yet it takes courage. It takes courage to look deeper, to go inwards on, especially, I am a big advocate. Not everyone likes when I say this, Jose, but I genuinely believe from the pure scientific level, everyone has trauma. Acute trauma is physical, sexual, the awful things that we all hear about and don't want to hear about. But developmental trauma or attachment trauma is where I feel confident in saying, actually, if you slow down enough, you'll see where, wow, these patterns of either neglect or inundation have impacted who I am and do impact how I live my life. Even when we have the courage to look at those patterns, we can often see. And one last thing I'll say here and pass it back to you is that when I see leaders shift in these ways of upgrading their emotional operating system, it trickles down so beautifully into the corporate organization, into the infrastructure of how everyone else feels.
That's incredible. That's incredible. And let me tell you something, because sometimes the leader are thinking that you had to make conscious decision and based on data, etc. But sometimes you have gut feelings. So how do I, as a leader, separate what is my intuition in something and what is something that's giving me anxiety? Because especially both could feel very similar. How can I see that it is I'm feeling bad because I'm having that gut feeling, or I'm really having anxiety? How can I have the difference?
Such a great question, Jose. And I'm afraid I don't have a quick, easy answer, but I do have a bit of a map, which is to say, give thanks. Integration, meaning a little bit of both. And what I've learned from my own just way of living, more of a connected life or a life of listening and call it prayer, call it meditation, is it's helped me realize, wow, so often those gut instincts are correct. And yet, not every single time does it mean go with that gut instinct. There are always many variables in a situation. And so what I offer is from the nerdy world of neuroscience, it would be called creating bihemispheric brain activity in order to navigate this, which means, okay, my gut is telling me I ought to, let's just use a random case example, I ought to fire this person. Just like, I just get a sense of that. And yet when I run through my left brain or the data, as you said, as the sort of the facts, it's like, well, wait, if I fire them right now, actually that's going to create a ripple effect and this, this, this. And so there's the example where in that one, I still know in my gut probably need to either fire this person or continue to work through something with them, but I'm not going to do it right away. Purely gut instinct. I'm going to blend some left brain intelligence into what the gut is feeling. And in the nerdy world, we call this brain-heart coherence, where the information's allowed to pass back and forth both ways. And yet in science, we know that originally, as we were all born as newborns, we are much more gut-feeling oriented, and later the left brain or intellect comes in. And so if you keep that algorithm, it's like, yeah, check in with the gut first, then make sure it makes sense. Make sure it doesn't crumble your whole world or your company or whatever it is, and they play off each other.
Okay, very, very nice. Where do the people can find you?
I am at hansonhealing.com. It's just my last name, H-A-N-S-O-N, the word healing. And that's the easiest way to reach out to me. And I'm up to some great projects. I've got Lead with Heart, which is another show here on Now Media Network that just recently launched, and really enjoying that as well. So you can check out that show. And I'm also working on mentalhealth.com. Slowly but surely, we're getting that project together. So you can stay tuned to that website and see the changes that are going to be coming this year. So thank you. Thanks, Jose.
Okay, so we're coming to the end of this segment, and we're going to be talking in the next segment about the when we're having adversity, that can be not only an external adversity, it can be internal adversity. So sometimes you spread that thought through your team, your culture, and it brings some burnout patterns. So we're going to be talking about those tense moments of negotiations, crisis headlines, grounded techniques, postures, nervous. Stay tuned. It's going to be a great conversation. No te muevas. Regresamos con más historias y estrategias para mantenerte firme cuando todo se te pone a prueba. Esto es Líderes Inquebrantables por Now Media Televisión. Estamos de vuelta. Soy José Pereira y estamos viendo Líderes Inquebrantables en Now Media Televisión. Sigamos descubriendo qué significa liderar sin quebrarse. Welcome back to Líderes Inquebrantables. I'm your host, José Pereira. In the last segment, we were talking about something very important that I missed something that was taking the pause. So, Dr. Jesse, I want to talk about the importance of taking a pause.
Whew. Yes, yes. Again, way easier said than done for all of us, and yet it is so vitally important. We covered in the last segment, the few segments we brought up, fight or flight. And that's another way of saying sympathetic nervous system. And it's no big secret to all of us, even though I am so blessed now to live here in Costa Rica, I still have the North American fast-paced life that was programmed into me so many years. And so I have empathy and I know how hard it is. And yet it is, I really do believe it's essential, especially as leaders, but really for all of us to learn how to take the pause. And what does that look like and why is it so important? Let's go with the why real quick. It's because it is nervous system regulation. It is self-regulation. It is self-attunement. It is a form of self-love. It's a practice that we can all do for free at any time. We just have to prioritize our own brain body, our own beingness, and as much as we're open to it, our own heart and soul to say, we deserve this. We need it. That the pace at which we are being pushed by the modern rat race culture is really not what our bodies were meant for. And I don't know that it's sustainable without everything else we see coming with it, tons of substances and materialism and all those things. So the pause looks like as simple as a deep breath And exhale the mouth. I encourage that mouth exhale because, like I named in the earlier segment, often our jawbones are tighter than they need to be. So even just an occasional breath out of the mouth helps to remind ourselves to slow down and to feel more present and to just check in. Maybe in that slowdown, it's that breath or two. And it's to check in, what do I need right now? As simple as do I need to just get a snack or go to the bathroom, or realizing I need more intimacy in my marriage or whatever it is, but it's that pause where we can also start to feel what we need.
You were talking about trauma, and trauma is a big thing. And there is something that had to do also with the cultural thing. Here in the US, trauma is a big thing here. So, but trauma is not only feeling the trauma, it's somatizing the trauma. So, in a tough season, what are the most common stress behaviors you can see in a team? The leader misreads sometimes. Like an attitude problem. How would they handle that?
Did you say like an anger problem?
Yeah.
So no, thank you. Yeah, again, trauma, that is obviously, it's a very deep subject. And what I would say is that, if you can think of it, I often call it, instead of trying to figure out who's diagnosable as PTSD or not, though there are clinical metrics for that and they have their place, I like this language I call trauma residue. It's to recognize we all have some kind of residue in us, even if it was, a heartbreak, and now as I start dating again, I feel a little more guarded around my heart. That's an example of trauma residue in a subtle way. And so if you look at it this way, in terms of like your example of anger management, what it means is that the angry leader is coming in holding trauma residue in their body, in their nervous system, in this case from anger, meaning places in their life that boundaries aren't being held appropriately. And so now, as the angry leader comes in with that trauma residue, can almost, again, in this sort of imagery-based idea, like as I come in and I am that leader, I'm like, ah, you know what? This is not okay. And this is not good enough. And what are you doing? And why are you 15 minutes late? And again, there's all just reasons to talk about those topics, yet there's a way to do it more gracefully. Whereas if I'm carrying that trauma residue, it's going to come out and come across as anger, as almost meanness, which is more connected to something from my personal life or my trauma history, as opposed to what's actually happening in the office.
I believe that emotional intelligence is key in all of this because sometimes you're having a tense situation in your office and you know how to handle it, or maybe you don't know how to handle it. So, what will be the difference in those first 10 minutes that something is going wrong? How they will handle it? A good leader, they understand what's going on. That could be related to PTSD or trauma.
I like that you said, in terms of being a great leader, as well as being able to attune, I think, is the main thing, to our own body. You mentioned emotional intelligence as well, Jose, and part of that is, yes, maybe being able to talk about emotions and feel more comfortable with it. But another part of it, when you get into the nervous system, is being able to track what are my symptoms, what are my signs that I am starting to feel angry, for example. So let's stay with this angry leader case example we're co-creating, is that, that person, like you said, probably 10 minutes before whatever blow up might happen, there are signs, there are indicators. The heart rate may be going up. I may be able to track that my jaw is getting very tight. I may be able to track, it's so obvious sometimes with anger. Sometimes how I work as a therapist is I'm sitting there talking to somebody about, let's just go with the classic mom or dad. And they're sitting there telling me it's fine, everything's really fine. Like, it wasn't a big deal. They did the best they could. But then I go, well, hey, can you look down at your hands? And I'm holding them up here so you can see them in the frame. But they would often be just resting on their legs and they're in tight fists. And I would say, well, it seems like someone in there might be a little bit angry about some of the things that happened. And so that's what I mean. We have these little tells that if we get to know ourselves and learn that, then I can know as that angry leader, okay, this is coming on. Let me do some breaths. Let me remember this is about this, and this from my childhood or from my family life right now. What's going on here is I need to be present with Sally, Joseph, and Mary to make sure that I talk to them as decent human, you know.
Yeah, it had to be a thought process. Let me tell you, sometimes leaders have the problem that they have to perform, they have high standards, they want to put pressure, but at the same time, they're activating the fear-based performance in their employee. How can you handle that?
Again, I think emotional intelligence is probably one of the most effective ways to really get to the roots of something like that. In the immediate sort of short-term coping skill ideas, exhaling the mouth. Again, anger tends to tighten in our limbs, so sort of opening there. Some people are comfortable even just shaking a little bit, things like this. But ultimately, Jose, I mean, where I would guide people is, you can do those things to kind of wipe the foam off the top or cool the boil of the water, and yet really having to go back in to look at, wow, why did I start feeling like perfectionism is the best way to move forward? And oftentimes, again, it has to do with our childhood programming or teenage or whatever point someone taught us that, someone sort of pressurized us that. And again, there's so much beauty in what that can do and what that can create in terms of success and productivity. And yet we've got to be enough, have enough emotional intelligence that we know where's that limit where I'm maybe taking it too far and either hurting myself or others around me.
Yeah. I'm talking now than something that really is fascinating. That is the intersection between the neuroscience and the ancient wisdom. I remember a book I read some time ago about the Toltecas. The Tolteca had a really an ancient wisdom, how to handle the way that people see the things. I remember that book mentioned that you can go to a theater, and then you can have several movies, the same movie in several theaters at the same time, but the people that was in one of the in the stage will be looking a different movie than the other, because everybody was looking to see the things with different lens. So what is that intersection between that neuroscience and the ancient wisdom that you can use for practical rituals or rhythm that really can help to that? To the teams.
Beautiful question. What comes up when you ask me that is that, again, bringing in a little more of the clinical language would say the experiential and imaginal brain respond the exact same. Dreams are a great example. When we wake up, we're falling in a dream. We wake up and it's as if we're falling until we realize, wait, okay, I'm in my bed, I'm safe. But for those moments where we believe it, our nervous system is responding as if that's happening. And that's a great way to ground your question, Jose, is to recognize that. Another little statistical piece is that you can take any event, but especially anything that's more intense or more likely to bring trauma, and everyone will remember it differently. If you had 10 people witnessing it and you interviewed all 10 of them, there would be a lot of common themes, but everyone would remember it in their own lens. And that's both complicated and beautiful to me. It's complicated at the level, especially as a therapist and sitting with people, couples, families, whatever, and it's like, no, this is what happened. No, this, and I'm like, hey, the truth is some combination in here, right? And what all is this to say, Jose, is to bring in modern, not only neuroscience, but quantum physics, integrate it with the ancient wisdom is to realize that, however we perceive our reality and ourselves in it and our relationships, that is how we will believe the world to be. And when we realize that, it's the quantum physics part is to realize that that's how we project electromagnetic energy out there to say, this is how I see what is happening. And yet when you look at the ancient wisdom, I feel like ancient ones knew this, that they were just more at peace with this to know, these concepts of manifestation or learning how to dream awake or create your reality. If listeners don't know, Dr. Joe Dispenza's work is amazing with this in terms of really mastering the art of bringing it into today's modern world and looking at what is the ways that I'm creating my reality around me based on my belief structures, my behaviors, my emotional patterns, my EOS, my emotional operating system. And the ancient ones knew this already, and they just sort of knew we are all here creating our own reality. Let's work together to create something more beautiful. Whereas today's world, we're getting more pushed into these individualized, little digital lives, right? And so the ancient wisdom would say, yes, it's true that we create our own reality, and how you perceive reality is going to dictate how you feel in your body and in your emotions. So let's do that wisely together.
Yeah, you're talking about Joe Dispenza. I love Joe Dispenza. And we're going to talk a little bit more in the next segment about that because that's really a fascinating topic. The pastor of my church, he always mentioned that neuroscience today is confirming what the Bible said more than 2,000 years ago. So
Yes.
that is so true. But we're going to deep dive a little bit more in the next segment. So stay tuned. We're going to continue in the last segment. No te muevas, regresamos con más historias y estrategias para mantenerte firme cuando todo se te pone a prueba. Esto es Líderes Inquebrantables por Now Media Televisión. Estamos de vuelta, soy José Pereira y estamos viendo Líderes Inquebrantables en Now Media Televisión. Sigamos descubriendo qué significa liderar sin quebrarse. Welcome back to Líderes Inquebrantables. I'm your host, José Pereira. If you want more episodes like this, you can watch Now Media TV live or on demand. Download the app on Roku, iOS, and my podcast at Now Media TV. So let's continue this conversation. Before we start the next topic, this is the last segment. I left the last topic about talking about neuroscience. And I mentioned that the pastor of my church, he always mentioned that neuroscience has confirmed what the Bible said more than 2,000 years ago. And again, we were talking about the praying. When you are praying intentionally and you're asking for something that you haven't seen, but you truly believe in that, that is the base of the faith. What is your thought about that?
Jose, your questions are in fuego. These are wonderful questions. Thank you. Faith is... I've said this for years, even before I fully completed my neuroscience degree, but faith is one of the most, if not the most powerful healing agent, whether you're going through Reiki energy healing or going through an intense medical surgery, having faith that you will be carried through it. And I definitely testify in my own personal work, as well as thousands of clients now, that when the more I see a person show up with faith, the more excited I am about the transformation that's coming. Now that's, let's call it spirituality based. When you bring in the neuroscience, here's where it gets really fun and interesting, Jose, is that what we commonly know about is fight or flight and parasympathetic or rest and digest. Those are very simplified descriptions of what those parts of our nervous system really do. And yet those have sort of dominated even medical worlds for a long time. Recently, only in the last roughly 20-ish years, Dr. Stephen Porges, as probably the leader of this movement, but he has the thing called the polyvagal theory. Not sure if you've heard of this or not, but polyvagal, in a quick nutshell, is the first origins of our own creation in our mother's womb, when sperm and egg come together and a zygote is created, and that what initially the first physical matter that becomes all of a human is called the vagus nerve. And so polyvagal is saying that as we grow, that vagus nerve starts to move into certain key areas. A lot of it's in our face, heart, and gut. But it's the point is that those, that part of our nervous system, if we can all just dare to imagine it for a few moments, being back in an environment where every need that we have is taken care of before we even think of it. We don't really even have to think. Our life is being sustained, and pray it be a pleasant environment in the family home. You know, assuming that, then it is also very safe emotionally for us, and for most of us in there it is. And so that, to me, that's just such a beautiful experience to think about. And that's the idea of what happens when we have faith. It starts to help activate our polyvagal nervous system, which helps us to have this feeling of, I'm okay, I'm being taken care of, I'm being nurtured, I'm getting stronger, you know, I exist. It's a very simple way, and yet if you look at it so often, what's underneath some of these maladaptive ways that leaders can, so let's say, act out and bring their trauma residue into the workplace, if they knew how to connect to polyvagal more often, then a lot of that starts to calm down or regulate. So trance is a faith, the activation of faith, the emotion of faith, the connection of faith helps to stimulate the polyvagal nervous system, which helps to regulate everything else.
You
And
know,
for fun ways, and you mentioned
I'm
biblical,
sorry.
like this would be called source codes. These are like the original codes of how we are meant to exist as humans, per God, per neurology, per creator.
You know, we're coming to the next segment that is something that really resonates a lot with me because the segment is called Surviving to Leading and Turning Pain into Purpose. But I want to talk about my personal story about that. You know, I was a hostage in Venezuela, and when I was there, I had the opportunity to read a book that maybe you have read it, that is Man in the Search of a Meaning of Viktor Frankl. And Viktor Frankl always talks about how you can turn the pain into a purpose. And when you understand that, you can make something that can really transcend. So I want to make you the question. What will be the difference between using adversity as a fuel instead of transforming in a pain?
From pain into purpose. Yeah, that also really resonates with me, Jose, as a trauma specialist. That is sort of the goal of trauma work, is to take something very painful and that really hurt and bring it into our purpose. And so I couldn't agree with you more on that, and Viktor Frankl. And I feel like that is something that, you know, each of us is tasked with, whether or not we live this life where we just keep creating more pain, or whether we learn this algorithm where we can transform pain into purpose, hopefully more and more regularly. So go ahead, Jose.
Wow. Let me tell you something because we're going to be talking about something that are those unspoken challenges that leaders have. So you're connected because you do clinical work, you do retreats, you have a broader platform that is mentalhealth.com. So I want to make you the question, what will be those beliefs leaders are craving most right now, but they are not admitting it?
Beautiful question again. And this is what I see is from, I'm gauging this from my own understanding of culture, as well as many hours in the therapy office with great leaders, is that I feel like what they're craving is the permission to be more human, the permission to be more vulnerable, the permission to admit that they're not always okay, and that in admitting that or owning that, you know, there's, I think that what keeps us all leaders, so many leaders holding it together and being fine, as we started off this show with, is that if I were to show this, I will lose my job, I will lose people's respect, I will be judged, et cetera, et cetera. And I feel like that's actually what m many leaders are secretly craving. And of course, I'm open to being wrong about it. It is simply my, you know, opinion and based on my expertise. And yet, as I hear myself say it out loud, it probably is even vulnerable to admit that as a leader. And yet, I feel like that's what they're looking for. And more leaders are also, as you mentioned, retreats, turning towards deep dives, turning towards realizing, wow, I do all this stuff and I make all this money, but am I actually happy? No, and often, sadly, no is the answer. And it's not because it's not in there. It's because there's so much pressure and not enough safe spaces for them to just be human and admit, wow, this is a lot. You know, and that's part of my dream and passion with what I'm up to, is continuing to create spaces for everyone, but especially for leaders, to be able to have these kind of processes and to create a culture where it's okay to admit sometimes I'm not okay, and it's okay if you are, and we are going to create cultural shifts in our companies that support these kind of processes. Because despite what AI and everything else is trying to almost force, like, we are still humans, right? And ultimately, business is dealing with humans. We can't be robots. We can't just function all the time without ever having any.
Because sometimes the leader thinks that he's a superhuman, And you know, we were talking about resilience, and that resilience is exactly that. Sometimes you will fall, but you have to stand up and try to bounce back. So when a leader is rebuilding his life or his business after a collapse, it could be a financial collapse on his relationship, whatever, what should he prioritize first so he can build it not from that what he did in the past? What would be your recommendation?
Mine would be to find a safe and sacred space, whether that's officially with a psychologist or a good friend or a mentor, but to really process what happened in the collapse. Again, whether it was a personal life marriage thing or whether the company that went down, is to give that person a space to process that. And in my language would say, clear the trauma residue so that as you rebuild, you can do that without, you know, making decisions based on, oh my gosh, but if I do that, I might be like that before, or I have to make this one because last time I did this and that wasn't it. So we're going this way. And then beyond that, Jose, I would say, you know, that would be a first step. And the next step would go into what I call embodiment, but really starting to learn, okay, wow, how am I wearing this? I feel so beaten down by this. I need to be conscious to open my heart back up and face whether these are new interviews, new meetings with potential new partners, whatever I'm doing, really track how I'm showing up physically to let it encourage and support this idea that I can rebuild, I can reboot, you know.
If somebody wants to contact you, say again how they can find you.
Easiest way is on my website, hansonhealing.com, H-A-N-S-O-N, healing.com. And also you can check out the work I'm up to, mentalhealth.com. And I have a show here on Now Media, Lead with Heart, where you can check out deeper conversations with leaders about how they have become who they are today.
So coming to the end, if you could leave a leader with one principle to stay unbreakable, what you will say to them?
I don't know about unbreakable. I would say resilience, you know, practice resilience. Let resilience become something that means a lot, and let it be okay to let there be ruptures, because they, in the repair, that's where the magic happens.
Well, thank you for being here. It has been a wonderful conversation. To everyone watching this, adversity will test you, but it can also train you, keep your standards high, keep your nervous system steady, and keep your humanity intact. I'm Jose Pereira, I'm your host, and this is Líderes Inquebrantables. Until the next time.